A subcontractor has to protect its own interest and read the fine print. If not, a company could be exposed to a minefield of problems with the prime. Tim Sullivan is a veteran of the contracting world and writer of the blog 10 Myths of Government Contracting. For the next five Tuesdays, we'll be exploring these myths with him. In today's installment, Sullivan tackles myth number five. Not to worry, my prime contractor will tell me what should be in our subcontract.
Anybody who relies on their customer, and that's what a prime is to a sub, for the terms of the deal is really going down the wrong path. You have to read what the prime gives you. Usually the primes are the ones who are going to say, here's our standard subcontract, sign it and send it back, and we're ready to go. And you've heard it, Tom. You've seen it. People are so anxious to get the deal, to book the business before month end or year end or whatever it is, that they'll sign anything, the marketing people will, without really reviewing it. And boy, the devil's in the details.
Or what are some of the types of clauses that can bite you?
Well, yeah, let me count the ways. The first thing I mentioned in the myth is the payment clause. If I'm going to look at a subcontract, if someone gives it to me and says, what do you think? I'm going to look at some basic things. I'm going to look at the payment terms. I'm going to look at the termination terms. I'm going to look at about four or five different things just to start and then take it from there. But you need to read through it. And payment is the first thing because, after all, you're in this to get paid and make money and pay your employees. And what will happen in many subcontracts is you'll find that the payment clause is what I'll call a pay-when-paid clause. That is, you can do all the work you want, but you're not getting paid until the prime gets paid. And the prime might not get paid for 60, 90, 120 days after a contract starts, for example. Can you, as a subcontractor, survive that period if you're really small and fragile? Can you survive going 2, 3, 4 months without a payment? So that is the first thing you look for, I think, is that the payment clause. But you can get a lot. There are a lot of ways to fix things here, or to change things if you're the prime, to put yourself in really terrific control. Remember, what a prime is doing here is they're running the program for the government, and so they've got to make sure they flow down the proper requirements to the subcontractors so that they can keep them all in line as they try to perform this contract as a team. And many contractors will actually go overboard when they flow these things down and actually change language to make it more onerous on the subs than it is on the primes. And so subcontractors need to look at that to see if the prime contractor has actually tweaked language, which looks like a fairly standard clause, in something that looks like a fairly standard clause, to make it more onerous than it should be. One of the examples I put in this myth number five was the termination for convenience clause. In the government contract world of prime contractors, that clause is so important, Tom, that it doesn't even have to be put into a prime contract. The courts have said they'll read it in as a matter of law. So you'd think, well, that is a very important clause. And as a public policy matter, it is. It allows Uncle Sam and the taxpayers an exit ramp whenever they think it's in the public's best interest to get out of a contract. Let's say we're winding down in Iraq. Rather than let these contracts go on for the next 2 years, they can simply exercise their termination for convenience rights. The contractor gets paid for what it's done, plus a profit on that, and everybody leaves. And there's no black mark on a contractor's record. So you'd think that's a pretty important clause, but believe it or not, it is not what we call a mandatory flowdown. So the primes look at that clause and think, well, we got to have it in there because we need to be able to control our subs in case we're terminated for convenience. So many of them simply flow it down, word for word. Well, a smart sub knows that the deal between the sub and the prime is a commercial contract. And in a commercial setting or common law, a termination for convenience is what you would call a breach of contract. You're walking away from a deal which both parties had signed and agreed to live up to. And so a smart sub will say to a prime, listen, we'll agree to a termination for convenience only if your prime contract is terminated for convenience. That's the only way that's going to happen. And if your prime contract is terminated only in part, you can only terminate us if the part that was terminated applies to our work.
Because
you
got to
put a fence around it.
You do hear a lot of subcontractors complaining that they get dropped after being bid, and then the prime contractor goes around and finds somebody else to do the same thing for cheaper. So maybe that's...
That's different. What happens there, Tom, is that generally these companies enter into what we call teaming agreements and TAs. And that is an agreement between, usually led by the prime, putting its team together, saying, okay, if we win this baby, then we're going to negotiate in good faith with you in an effort to award a subcontract to you. Now, we could talk for hours about this, but we don't have hours. What often happens is that the prime wins it and then for one reason or another doesn't use the team that was the companies, a company or companies that was on its team. Happens all the time. The problem here is that most courts have held in most states that teaming agreements are nothing more than unenforceable agreements to agree. And so we've had to break this bad news to our clients many times to tell them that this teaming agreement probably isn't worth the paper it's written on. Because if for somehow you don't actually get that subcontract with the prime, you don't have a remedy. So that's what you're talking about. It happens all the time. I shouldn't say that. Most primes live up to these things. It's sort of the exception rather than the rule that that primes won't live up to the teaming agreements.
Tim Sullivan is a partner at the law firm Thompson Coburn. And it's great to try to find out what clauses you should have as a subcontractor. But the fact is that most of the leverage is with the prime. And the bigger they are, the more leverage they seem to exert. So how can a small sub or any sub get some leverage to get contract clauses that are more favorable or at least more equitable?
Well, you're right that generally you assume that the customer has more leverage, but not always. I have seen, having represented many primes over the years, where they're so intent on getting this one particular sub because of its expertise, its personnel, its reputation, that actually they will do a lot to make sure they get them in the fold. But I would say that's the exception rather than the rule. What I would say to most subcontractors is that, yep, the leverage probably is on the prime side, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't go back and ask for fair and equitable language in your subcontracts. Sometimes you can get it, sometimes you can't. If you think dealing with the government is a bureaucracy and can be frustrating, you ought to see how some of the major primes operate. And that can be very tough for a small subcontractor to deal with it. But if you keep your exceptions within reason, if you couch them using reasonable language, you'd be surprised what you can achieve as a subcontractor.
Is there any guidance from the Small Business Administration for primes and small contractors to get along better, especially since a lot of the primes need to use their subs in order to meet their small business contracting goals?
Not that I'm aware of. The Small Business Administration does have a lot of guidance online, but this is one of the great uncharted worlds out there. That is the world of subcontracting. The regulations don't reach them theoretically, although many of the clauses are flowed down. And it's the wild, wild west out there. And even within it, let's say you're dealing with a major prime, let's say a Northrop Grumman. The way the Northrop Grumman people in Washington treat you might be different than the way the Northrop Grumman in Florida treat you. The different offices, different people, different cultures. They may have been acquired by Northrop Grumman only 2 years earlier, and the culture from the prior company is still there. So there's no one-size-fits-all in this business, and basically what you want is someone experienced to help you work through these things.
And many times these very large companies have centralized procurement or purchasing operations that might be, sometimes they're not even in the United States. Like their billing offices might be outside of the United States, and you've got to go through all sorts of hoops and forms. It doesn't matter whether you're a giant machining company or a sole practitioner. Everybody goes through the same meat grinder.
Well, I haven't encountered that particular problem, I haven't had anyone complain to us about this, but it takes us back to where we started, Tom, and that is that the payment clause and the methodology that's in there for how payments are made and how you submit your invoices is very important stuff. And as a simple rule, my approach has always been, you keep it simple. The more complex that becomes, the tougher it's going to be for that sub to get paid. And if I read a payment clause and I don't understand it on the first read through, that's a problem. And anything you can do to demystify it, to break it down into simpler, understandable language, is very important for the sub.